and the Taliban and so on, they are today operating around the world thanks to the existence of the National Endowment for Democracy and other such outfits, proxies of the United States trying to foment regime change, secession, etc., in what would otherwise be quite stable and even beneficial regimes around the world. So really, the calling these outfits Hamas and Hezbollah proxies of Iran is simply really a form of projection, and it is shameful. It is shame on the media today that it so cooperates in the decontextualization that allows these accusations to do their work, even among the small number of people in the world among whom these accusations become effective. The fact of the matter is the world is essentially waking up to the fact that the United States is engaged in a completely illegitimate, and by the way, I should add, I mean, I'll let Dimitri go on this, but illegal in international law forms of activity all around the world.
Before you jump in, Dimitri, I'd say, you know, by calling Hamas or Hezbollah proxies, what you're saying is that they have no legitimate grievances. They're just carrying out the will of some powerful patron, you know, who's moving them on the chessboard. Dimitri?
It certainly amounts to delegitimizing their grievances, right? You are, as you suggested, David, by calling them a proxy, denying their agency. I don't think in any situation where we have a proxy, I mean, certainly none of the major sort of proxy conflicts that we've seen, there's a completely bright line between being a proxy and being an actor, an independent actor. There are degrees of independence. You know, is there a degree of dependence between Hezbollah and Iran? Sure. But does that mean that Hezbollah exercises no autonomy, that it has no legitimate grievances of its own? I think that my sense of, I watched and listened very carefully to Hassan Nasrallah's speech. My sense of the man and of the leadership of Hezbollah, whatever you may think of the organization, is that they are actually quite concerned about how a full-scale war is going to affect the supporters of Hezbollah, the fighters of Hezbollah, and the people of Lebanon. Quite independently of what Iran may want, I would be very surprised if that is not influencing their behavior to a very significant degree. And I'm sure that the same is true of Hamas, wherever it may be deriving its support. And again, whatever you may think of Hamas, I can't imagine that the leaders of Hamas aren't weighing carefully to some degree how their decisions and their actions are going to impact their movement within Gaza and within the occupied Palestinian territories, and how these are going to impact the people of Gaza. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to make necessarily the most humane decisions or the right decisions, but to suggest that these people, the leaderships of these two organizations, are not influenced by factors and concerns that are particular to their people and their constituents, I think is detached from reality.
There's this very dramatic tension emerging between the will of global civil society to go out in the street and protest in Berlin and in Toronto and Amsterdam and Rotterdam and New Delhi, all around the world. And on the other hand, the response of certainly Western governments to suppress protest and free speech. And I want to point out the head of Florida State University system ordering campus chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine to be shut down under apparent directive from Governor DeSantis. A soccer player of Arab or Muslim background has been suspended from the German football team because of statements that he made on social media. In France and in Germany, protests being banned. Sarah Jama, her expulsion from the Ontario NDP caucus for having expressed solidarity with Palestine. What's your understanding of this confrontation between the will of global civil society to express support for Palestine and the will of Western nations to block that? What's going to happen?
Well, what's going to happen is that this will be another, I would say, very big and important chapter in demonstrating the disconnect between Western leaders who are essentially the agents of a plutocracy and the ordinary people of Western countries, who, you will remember, are today a very mixed bunch. There are among them all sorts of minorities, including Jewish minorities, but also including Muslim minorities. And so I would say that this disconnect is going to manifest itself more and more clearly. But may I also say one other thing about the proxy issue? You know, everybody knows that the United States thinks of its proxy war against Russia, with Ukraine as a proxy, in terms of China as well, where presumably it seeks to use Taiwan as a proxy against China. Now, I think the Taiwanese are beginning to wise up to this, and they will be, and it'll be good if they do. But what would be the analogy in the Middle Eastern region? It would be that they will use Israel as a proxy to fight Iran. I think this is something that should make everybody who is in the region and everybody who is in Israel quake in their shoes.
Well, I think we're seeing an absolutely unprecedented level of censorship in the West. And I'll just give one example. There's a bill, I understand, before the Assemblée Nationale in France, which would impose potentially a penalty of 2 years imprisonment or a fine of 75,000 euros on anyone who, quote unquote, insults the state of Israel. Now, we've seen legislation like this in plenty of countries where the head of state of that country or the government of that country was being insulted allegedly. Here, what France is doing is they are going to punish people severely, potentially, for insulting a foreign state. This is unprecedented. And I have two comments about this. I've always maintained that the severity of a censorship regime is directly proportional to the horrors that that regime is trying to conceal. The reason why we are seeing unprecedented levels of censorship in the West with respect to condemnations of Israel and Palestinian solidarity is because the horrors that they are now trying to conceal are so mind-boggling. That's the first thing I want to say about this. And the second thing is, this is years in the making. You know, I and others on the left have been complaining for years that the censorship that some people on the left in the progressive community were supporting. So, for example, during the pandemic, even though I myself was largely in agreement with the measures taken by the government to deal with that public health emergency, I did not agree that they should be censoring members of the medical profession who had dissenting views. I did not agree during the war, the proxy war in Ukraine, that people who were criticizing the West's support for Ukraine and saying that there's some legitimacy to what the Russians are saying about this war, that they should be censored. And I was saying very loudly and clearly, even if I disagreed with somebody, we on the left should not be supporting censorship because it will be turned upon us. And that's exactly what's happening now. The chickens are coming home to roost. And I hope all those people in the left and the progressive community over the last several years who were cheerleading censorship will now realize that that was a terrible mistake.
You've brought up Ukraine, of course, and we're moving towards a discussion of Ukraine. It's interesting and not very surprising that Ukraine is now, well, I wouldn't say totally out of the news, but it's been kind of eclipsed, the Ukraine conflict. And I was watching Al Jazeera today and seeing that it's at a, apparently the word term stalemate has been used to describe the situation in Ukraine. And I gather that Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, has just paid a visit to Kyiv and has been visiting Volodymyr Zelensky and trying to provide him with some encouragement that there is a pathway to joining NATO, and you know, arms shipments will continue to flow, even though now the U.S. is really, really strapped. And it's fascinating that Republicans are trying to now, you know, pass this legislation that would send a mind-blowing $14 billion, earmark $14 billion for Israel, but nothing for Ukraine, because the Republicans, the MAGA Republicans, they don't like to support Ukraine. You have to laugh to keep from crying sometimes. Radhika?
Well, Ukraine war has been unpopular in the United States for quite a long time, as it has been in other European capitals. What And in fact, by the way, the Ukraine war has been lost by the West for some considerable time. The term stalemate is still a euphemism in the present context. So what we are witnessing is a situation in which the West will have lost, but the loss cannot be admitted, because the moment you admit the loss, then you are held. The leaders in power, President Biden, Olaf Scholz, Mrs. von der Leyen, etc., are left holding the can. They will be blamed for pursuing this completely unreasonable war beyond the point where it could be won. That's the first thing. The second thing is, of course, that, yes, I think that the rest of the world continues to recognize the legitimacy of Russia's concerns. And I would say that current events in Israel, Gaza, etc., are going to further reinforce the conviction that is why that exists in the world, that what the United States is doing is completely illegitimate, and this will extend itself to Ukraine. So yes, President Zelensky is now apparently quite alone. Time magazine has published a story in which he is quoted as saying, "Nobody believes in Ukraine's victory as much as I do." Nobody does. That is to say, only he is left essentially trying to pursue this war. And by the way, he needs to pursue this war because the funding that Ukraine is getting is actually as much for fighting the war, whatever it is, you know, whatever weapons he is getting. And the capacity of the West to supply weapons is also exhausted. But it is also for keeping Ukraine going day to day. And there, too, the money that is flowing to Ukraine, as everybody knows, given the level of corruption in the Ukraine government, is not necessarily going to ordinary Ukrainians. It is also being pocketed by the likes of Zelensky, who are themselves exceedingly rich personally.
Look, I think that what we're seeing in the Republican Party, the wing of the Republican Party that is opposed to further funding, what we're seeing in, for example, Germany, where the AfD, his soaring in the polls, I think in large part due to the fact that it wants to bring an end to this proxy war and the funding of Ukraine. What we're seeing is the populist right is exploiting public sentiment where the left should be stepping into the breach, the anti-imperialist pro-peace left. And because we failed to do that, and I'm going to harp on this, too many people on the left, too many people in the progressive community supported this depraved proxy war. I and Radica and many others have been saying for months that this was going to end up in a devastating defeat for Ukraine, and that's exactly where we were. Not because we're military geniuses, but because anybody who was looking at the evidence in an objective, dispassionate manner could see that that is where this was heading. Obama himself said when he was the president that Russia has escalation dominance in this theater of conflict. We knew that this was going to end in the defeat of Ukraine, and we on the left, too many of us, didn't have the moral courage, frankly, to stand up and say that this was not being done in the interests of the Ukrainian people and it was potentially going to cause a nuclear conflict. And so what has happened now? Now you have people on the right who have the political acumen to see that there's a void there, stepping in and filling the void. They're doing it in the United States. They're doing it in Germany. They're doing it elsewhere. And it's time for us on the left to stand up and be true to our principles, our anti-imperial, anti-war, anti-militarist principles, and re-seize the mantle of peace from these fake peaceniks on the right.
You know, at the end of September, correct me if I'm wrong, Radica Desai, it was at the end of September that you went to Russia, to Sochi, to attend the annual gathering of the Valdai Discussion Club. And then found out after, I think, returning home that the Valdai Discussion Club is actually sanctioned by the Canadian government. And I went in to the Canadian government website and found, of course, that, amongst scores and scores of individuals and government institutions and departments and ministries and rich people and others, newspapers, magazines, cultural institutions, referred to as Russian Moldovan disinformation agents peddling Russian disinformation and propaganda. And the Valdai Discussion Club is in there, of course. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this idea that the Canadian government could declare a discussion club, an annual academic gathering of politicians and academics engaging in discourse, free discourse with international visitors, as propaganda so vile and dangerous that it's got to be sanctioned. This kind of blows my mind. I mean, a discussion club.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, let me clarify one small thing. I knew before I went to Sochi that Valdai had just been sanctioned. A few days before we were to leave for Sochi, we received a message from the Valdai Club saying, we have just heard that your government has sanctioned us. We would understand if you do not wish to come. So Alan and I, my husband and I, we sat down, we read the sanctions law, we consulted friends of ours, including Dimitri, obviously speaking in a completely informal capacity, and Dimitri was not the only one. We read the law very closely and we decided to go because we did not feel that the sanctions applied to us. That's the first thing. The sanctions do not, the way in which they are worded is actually very interesting, but they do not apply to attending a conference. We were aware that if the government wanted, they could harass us with a frivolous lawsuit. This was a possibility, but then we were willing to take that risk. And the reason we wanted to go there is also the reason why Dimitri went some months ago to Russia on his own. It is important to keep up a people-to-people dialogue. Alan and I have decades of contact with Russia. We work with several different groups of Russian scholars and activists and so on. And so we absolutely wanted to go. We were going to be in Valdai. We were going to meet many friends there. And of course, we have participated in Valdai before. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that, you know, the level of mendacity of our governments, particularly the Canadian government, vis-a-vis Russia, knows no bounds. Not only do they want to sanction all sorts of cultural and educational institutions, calling them instruments of disinformation, which is simply a form of projection, because where is the disinformation? The disinformation is in the Western media. In the Western media, you have only wall-to-wall disinformation about Russia. And where does it come to? We are deplatforming Russian composers, Russian writers, you know, Dostoevsky or Tchaikovsky, in a way that I don't think we did when the Western world was fighting Nazis. We didn't do that to German culture. So essentially, our governments have lost all sense of proportion. And the sanctions are not there actually to prevent business taking place between Canadians and Russians, because there are loopholes like the size of black holes, basically, in those sanctions laws, which allow all sorts of business to continue. All sorts of Canadian companies are continuing to do business. And what's more, the sanctions are there essentially for the government to harass people and generally to intimidate people. The idea is that if you read Valdai's sanction, you will refuse to go, and you should refuse to go. That is the intention, but they basically have very little legal leg to stand on.
Well, first of all, some sanctions that the West has imposed upon Russia are obviously designed to prevent Russia from developing and sustaining its military-industrial complex. Others are designed clearly to inflict severe damage on the Russian economy, irrespective of whether it's related to the military-industrial complex, and thereby bring hardship upon the Russian people, so that the theory being they will rise up against Vladimir Putin. And then there are some sanctions which are just straight-up censorship. And that's what this Valdai Club sanction is. It's just straight-up censorship. The Valdai Club isn't producing missiles. It isn't producing artillery shells. It isn't producing drones. It is a forum for discussion, and telling people that if they participate in that discussion with people from Russian society who are influential, and we're in a position where we are potentially going to find ourselves in World War III with Russia, that speaking to this people is a violation of the law, to my mind, is absurd. And it's extremely dangerous to say that the wise approach is to cut off all lines of communication, even at the level of academics, such as Radhika and Alan Freeman are. My God, I mean, this is just the most ridiculous form of censorship. And the second thing I want to say is, you know, Radhika, what she's been attacked for in the media is for asking President Putin a question about the two standing ovations given by the Parliament of Canada to a Ukrainian Nazi. And the claim in the CBC, the national taxpayer-funded broadcaster, was that Radhika's question permitted the Russian president to condemn Canada. Now, just stop and think about that for a second. Do we really think that Vladimir Putin needed anybody's permission to mock the Parliament of Canada for this disgraceful event where they gave two standing ovations to a Nazi? I mean, seriously? This is just an attempt to intimidate Radican Allen into not maintaining a professional academic discourse with people from the Russian intelligentsia. And that's dangerous. It's wrong. We should maintain lines of communication.
And I mean, bringing this back full circle, the United States and the European nations, states, should be communicating with Hamas. They should have been communicating with Hamas years ago, and they should be communicating with Hezbollah. They should have been years ago. That there are no individuals in the world, no forces, no political parties, state entities or non-state entities who pose a challenge or a threat potentially to the West, who we shouldn't be talking to, finding ways to talk to. I mean, that's the way you resolve conflict.
Absolutely. This is the most fundamental principle of diplomacy. You talk to your enemies. If your desire is ultimately to resolve conflict by peaceful means and minimize the suffering that violent conflict generates, you should never stop talking to your enemies. No matter how vigorously you may disagree, no matter how heinous you think they may be, because ultimately peace serves the collective interest more than war.
And, you know, I just want to go back to something. First of all, let me just say that, you know, there is actually, if the United States wants to talk to Hamas or Hezbollah, they can do so. Apparently, Qatar has always acted as an intermediary. But the point is, there is some really interesting sort of smoke and mirrors going on around here, because they, in fact, are talking to them. But anyway, the point what I'd like to make is actually return to a point that Dimitri made earlier. Because, you see, the real issue here is that we need a left. We need an anti-war, pro-developmental, anti-imperialist left, which unfortunately does not exist. And you know why we need it? Because what all these activities show us, what the West is and the US are doing in Ukraine, what they're doing in Gaza, Israel, etc., what all this shows us as well is that, quite frankly, if you think that the West knows what it's doing, that there's somebody in each one of these capitals that is somehow in command and going to a clearly identified goal, we are wrong. Actually, we are living under governments that are kind of increasingly out of control. And the point where they're going to lose their purchase on what's going on may not be far away. And when that point comes, if there is no left, guess who is going to be left picking up the pieces? It will be the right. And I think this is what we need to be afraid of, because essentially the paradigm of neoliberalism combined with tokenistic social liberalism, which has been essentially the ruling paradigm for the last many decades, is exhausted. It cannot solve our problems. It cannot solve the world's problems. It is continuously prone to war because it is essentially devoted to all those interests, including the interests of the military-industrial complex, which it is going to pursue whether or not it makes any sense in any national interest, however defined. These people are not any more politicians. They are, to go back to a word we were using earlier, only proxies for the most powerful corporate, financial, militarized interests in the land.
Dimitri, last comments, briefly, if you can.
I hope that we have drawn from this experience. This war is over, the Ukraine war. It has caused untold death and suffering. And I hope that we will all take the opportunity now and reflect upon the absolutely quintessential importance of always communicating with our friends and our enemies. If there's any lesson that we can draw from this for the benefit of humanity, that should be the lesson.
And also, it is not just a discussion. We also have to commit ourselves to what I have in other contexts called a pluripolar world, a world in which every country and every people has the right to chart their own destiny in whatever way they want, that it is not up to us to tell them what kind of political system they should have and what kind of economic system they should have. Because in the name of human rights and democracy, all we've been doing is imposing a one-size-fits-all neoliberalism whose only purpose is to open up these countries to imperial exploitation.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if the international institutions could be reformed, if the United Nations could be reformed, if the Security Council could be turned into a place where effective action could be taken to advance peace and security, rather than vetoing their proposal and then we veto their proposal?
Amen. I just said amen. That's all I had to add to that.
Yes. Well, and I just like to say that actually, you know, when we speak of reform, I think the reform is really trying to bring the United Nations back from the place where the United States has led it, where by starving UN agencies of funds, it has essentially made UN agencies prey to corporate interest and, of course, to American interest. But this is less working less and less. The original principles of the UN Charter, as the group of friends of the UN Charter has emphasized, which includes a whole lot of countries that the United States hates, as they have emphasized, the UN Charter is actually quite a good charter, and because it was written at a moment when the West's power was at its nadir, and they had to take account of both the communist world and the developing world in fashioning that charter. So I think that you could actually go back to the essential principles of that charter, which is equal sovereignty, non-aggression, peaceful coexistence, and all that. And I think it would be good, but the reason our governments cannot is because they are creatures, like I said, of big corporate interests, and they are slavishly so, and they do not see, they are essentially the fly in the ointment of a better working world.
This is truly the last question for Dimitri Lascaris. It seems to me that the one of the central problems in the world today, if not the central problem, is that international law has been rendered irrelevant, that international law is not the fundamental term of reference for state activities.
Yes, you've reminded me, David, of a critique that I have been articulating a great deal recently, and that is a critique of the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court has had some 20 years since it was brought into existence to indict one or more Israeli war criminals. It is absolutely crystal clear that the Israeli regime has committed an array of war crimes, not the least of which is the settlements, which are a slam dunk violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention and a war crime under the Rome Statute. And yet it has done absolutely nothing. Meanwhile, within, I think, 12 months of the start of the invasion in Ukraine, they indicted the ICC, a sitting president of the Russian Federation, for an alleged crime that it pales in comparison to the crimes that Israel is currently committing today. What has happened as a result of this is that the entire system of international justice has been brought into disrepute. A discriminatory system of justice, one that allows a certain category of wrongdoers impunity and another that prosecutes them with expedition, is not justice at all. It is simply a tool of imperialism. And at the end of the day, where we now are is that the international legal architecture has been completely discredited, in large part because of the ICC's flagrant double standard. And I think that what we need to do is we need to start all over again. We need to construct a new international adjudicator for violations of international law. Clearly, the ICC has failed, and it is more of a problem than a solution to the crisis of disregard for international law.
Dimitri Lascaris and Radhika Desai, thank you so much for this very exhilarating discussion on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you, David.
Thanks for having us.
Radhika Desai is professor in the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba. Dimitri Lascaris is a Canadian lawyer, journalist, and activist based in Montreal and Greece. This was just part of our conversation. Listen to all of it at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
This is Anuki, your Faculty of Environment representative, here to let you know what the SFSS is. The SFSS is a student union that is student-led, and it represents and advocates for the interests of the 26,000 undergraduate students at SFU. We are a non-for-profit support network and a voice at SFU, which provides services like the UPass and health and dental. We also provide support to make your student life better. You can reach the SFSS on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or by emailing us. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.